The U.S. Open is coming to Pittsburgh next June at Oakmont Country Club. Golf's biggest stars will compete at the 125th U.S. Open, and a variety of daily and weekly ticket packages are now available. Give the gift of golf this holiday season. No venue has hosted more U.S. Opens than this iconic course, and the world's best players will be challenged at Oakmont for a record 10th time in 2025. Visit usopen.com/tickets today to witness golf history.
Word on Today FM.
And so a day later than usual, and as it happens for the last time this year, but he will be with us regularly as ever during 2025. We're delighted to have our last word on the environment correspondent John Gibbons with us. Good evening to you, John.
Good evening, Matt.
Now, I want to start with the Climate Change Advisory Council saying that climate action will deplete living standards, but delaying it would be even worse. And I think that actually might put the finger on the nub of the problem here, is that people do not want their existing living standards to be in any way impacted by taking action against climate change.
I think that's a fair way to put it, Matt. I suppose the way we probably should think about climate action is the way we think about insurance. You know, people take out insurance policies every day, and we do that, and it costs money, but we do it to mitigate against risk, especially against unbearable, unmanageable risk. And that's why we, you know, we're prepared to sacrifice some of our income today to protect us against the unknown and against tomorrow. So I think the approach to climate is very similar to that. We have to take a risk mitigation approach. And what the Climate Advisory Council, and frankly, Matt, this is really quite a radical document. I mean, for example, they're saying that we need to urgently phase out all internal combustion cars. That means petrol and diesel cars gone. And that includes, by the way, hybrids gone. And they're saying that we need to be phasing these out in the 2020s. Now, this is absolutely the first time that I've heard certainly a state body come forward with something as radical as that. And I think that will come as a shock to a lot of people. But what the Climate Advisory Council are doing is they're laying it on the level here and saying we're in a really, really deep hole on emissions. Ireland, we've had, you know, a lost decade back in the 2010s into 2020. We've done a little bit better. For example, last year we managed to cut our national emissions by just under 7%. But what they're saying is all the way out to 2040, Matt, we've got to cut our emissions in total by 2/3. That means cutting 6.3% straight line every single year. Now, that is much bigger deal than people might think it is, because the first few percent cut in any budget is fairly easy. You cut off the stuff that's not essential, but eventually you're going to start cutting really hard and really deep. And these are the options that are what we're left with. And part of what they're proposing here, for example, and again, this is really quite new. They're suggesting that about 400,000 hectares of land that is currently being used for beef and dairy production in Ireland needs to be taken out of that production and put into basically other forms of production, less polluting forms of production. We have got to get our agri-methane emissions down by between 22 and 30%. And we've got to get our nitrous oxide emissions down even more sharply than that. And the type of, you know, tricking around little technical things that have been the focus, say, in recent times, particularly through Chagas, they just won't cut it. The only way to achieve the kind of emissions cuts that we're talking about here are with the strong action that we've just described. So, for example, phasing out internal combustion cars. Also, we need to start looking at phasing out boilers, fossil fuel boilers. And that also, by the way, includes gas boilers. So what they're basically saying, Matt, is we need to exit the fossil fuel era really, really rapidly.
I can understand why they're putting this forward, but how are they going to persuade people to do it? Because it seems that the public doesn't want to do that.
I agree. And again, back to my insurance analogy, Matt, it isn't really kind of what we want, it's what we need to do. And the council described it in these terms, and I would agree with them. They say that what's required is the most significant change to the Irish economy since the foundation of the state. And what I find kind of interesting in looking at this is that this is going to require, the critical element here that's required is strong political leadership. Now, obviously, the Greens won't be part of any government that will be implementing this in the coming years. That means that there's nowhere to hide, really, for other parties. They can't just use the Greens as a kicking boy saying, oh, they're making us do this stuff. Basically, this is the state's own climate oversight body, laying it on the line, guys, this is what we need to do. This is where we have to go. And as we discussed quite recently, some of the options for doing nothing, apart from climate breakdown, which is pretty unpleasant and pretty expensive, we also are looking at potentially massive EU-level fines for failing to comply. And I know some people will say, well, will they really happen? But they're certainly something that they're far too large, Matt, for us to be blasé about and assume that they will be magicked away.
There was a report out this week as well suggesting that cyclists and those in e-scooters are 11 times more likely to get injured on our roads than motorists, which brings us to an American study which says that vehicle height compounds the dangers for pedestrians when they're hit by a vehicle.
That's right. Basically, I suppose what Ireland has in common with America is a love affair with the SUV, the suburban utility vehicle. We have the highest penetration of SUVs in Europe, probably reflecting the fact that Ireland tends to follow an American pathway culturally and so on. But basically, the key issue with SUVs, apart from their size and restrictions on visibility, the key issue is the height of the front of the vehicle. And what this study basically found, and I'll walk you through it very briefly, the average speed of a collision in the US is about just over 40 kilometers an hour. Now, in a regular shaped car with a normal tapered nose, about 60% of people will experience, pedestrians or other vulnerable road users will experience moderate injuries or 30% serious injuries at that 40 kilometer an hour collision. Now, if you switch vehicle at the same speed, Matt, which is 40 kilometers with a high front, suddenly it's 83% receiving moderate injuries and 62%, in other words, two-thirds serious injuries. So it is drastically more dangerous to be struck by a vehicle with a high front than it is with your typical tapering sort of saloon-shaped car. And in a sense, that's kind of obvious. The original car shapes, which are designed to be aerodynamically efficient, they also have the advantage that they tend to throw, if you strike a pedestrian, the energy is deflected away. The problem, of course, with the high-fronted vehicles is they basically run right over you and smash you downwards onto the ground. So what we're finding basically is that because we have followed this American pathway of SUVs, we're seeing a much higher risk, exposure risk, even at low speeds. And a few of the things, Matt, that came out of this that I think are super interesting, they're saying that our speed limits are too high. For example, they're saying that in urban areas, an absolute maximum speed limit in the US of about 20 miles an hour, in Europe of about 30 kilometers an hour is a maximum for urban areas. And there is a case to be made. It mightn't be popular necessarily among SUV owners, but there is a case to be made that SUVs, because of the unique risk that they pose to pedestrians, should in fact be more restricted than regular vehicles. They should, for example, have lower speed limits to account for the fact that they're so much more dangerous. And this, of course, Matt, assumes all other things being equal. In other words, your typical SUV driver who's as safe or as unsafe as any other driver. So when you take the driver element out of it and simply the danger inherent in the vehicular shape and size, and that really, it's a very strong message coming out of this study, and I think it's something that we would do well to reflect on here.
Something you mentioned earlier was getting rid of all fossil fuel-based internal combustion engines, going strictly to electric cars. Because there's another interesting study that's come out, which suggests that bad and all as traffic may be with all of those cars, that wood burners in the house are doing more pollution.
Yeah, it's a remarkable study that came from the University of Birmingham. And what they find basically is 25% of these very harmful particulates. So basically, these are called PM2.5s. These are, I suppose you and I might call them smog or smoke. But these basically are released during incomplete combustion. So for example, if you light a stove or you light a fire and maybe the wood is a little damp, and basically that dark smoke that you get off of that is rich with PM2.5s. Now these things are really, really bad for us. We know, for example, that the PM2.5s, they're so fine that they're able to pass, when we inhale them, they pass through the blood-brain barrier and they end up in our blood vessels and even in our brains. So they're really, really nasty. They're also implicated, for example, in heart disease, respiratory disease, high stroke levels and so on. So they're bad things. And it is it's an irony, Matt, that there was a swing maybe over the last 10 or 15 years towards wood burning stoves, and maybe away from open fires and towards wood burning stoves, which kind of made sense. They're obviously a stove in energy terms is vastly more efficient. But what they found is the massive increase in stove usage has created an air pollution problem, in particularly in urban areas. And this is something that they're drawing attention to here. And they found, for example, in the particular area they studied near Birmingham, that wood burning concentrations were 7 times higher in the 2020s than they were 10 years ago. So what that says is basically more of these devices are being used. And I suppose some people may perhaps at one time have thought that they were a greener option. But I guess science is always evolving, and we're always trying to kind of find, you know, sometimes when you bring in a measure that has a maybe a green element to it, you find out afterwards that it also has maybe a very negative counterpoint.
So I can imagine there are people thinking they were all persuaded back in 2008 to move over to diesel cars instead of petrol, and that didn't work out. Anyway, there's one other one that I want to ask you about before we finish, and that is an issue you have with, if you're going to use public transport, the signage, particularly on the Dart.
Yeah, I use the Dart probably. I'm lucky enough to live near it, so I use it probably every day of the week. In fact, I'll use it in the next hour or two. Now, the issue here, I was at a Dart station in Sandymount recently, and a foreigner, a tourist, came up to me and said, "Excuse me, which side of this track do you go to for the city?" So I directed her across to the other side. And then I sort of made a point then, Matt, of having a look around the station to find out, you know, is this not signed? Surely to goodness. And it isn't. So then I made some inquiries. I posted online about it, and people are posting back and responding, saying, this is the case all over the place. The signage is absolutely hopeless. And for example, you might say that there's an electronic sign that says Hoth, but what use is that to somebody from out of town? They don't know the direction of it. I mean, rather than saying Hoth, maybe we should say Hoth via city centre. It's all basic stuff. And the other, I suppose, bugbear of mine in relation to the Dart, and given that it's 40 years running, Matt, maybe there's a few of these things that they might like to take up one of these days. The second one is that when you're actually on a Dart at night, and you're coming through a station, and I've encountered this, and I've seen people frantically scrambling to look out the fogged up windows in your Dart to figure out what station you're in, because the station signage in Dublin on the Dart line is not illuminated, which means that when you're inside an illuminated Dart, looking out into the dark, you can't tell where you are. Now, sometimes the signage within the Dart works, as often as not, it doesn't. But these are really, really basic things. I mean, we all love our public service. We are our public transport. We've seen a huge uptake, by the way, in recent years in public transport. The measures that I'm talking about here are not expensive, and they would be hugely welcomed by the public. And I say this as somebody who's a major fan of the Dart, but for goodness sakes, we can do better.
Thank you so much for that. John Gibbons, thank you for all your contributions throughout the year, and we look forward to our regular weekly Last Word on the Environment all the way through 2025.
The Last Word on Today FM.